Of all Jewish holidays, it is Sukkot that appears most out of place in today's world. The dwelling in huts, the hoisting of palm fronds aloft, this seems at first blush utterly irreconcilable with the age in which we live. To the cynical, it is an anachronism. To the uninitiated, it is inconceivable that people would freely choose to live in this way. My favorite Sukkot story is told in Tablet magazine by Devorah Klein Lev Tov, who writes that, quote, "My mother's family was one of the last Jewish households to leave Detroit for the suburbs. One year on Sukkot, often a chilly holiday in Michigan, the family was huddled in the sukkah on a Friday night, eating bowls of warm cholent, a slow simmering stew of meat, potatoes, and beans. Suddenly, two men with guns burst in demanding money, an increasingly common occurrence in Detroit at that time. My mother and her family, having no money with them because it was Shabbat and a Chag, just stared at the men, unsure of what to do next. And as the men stared back, one looked at his companion and said, 'I don't think these people have anything. They're sitting in a hut eating beans. They've got less than we do.' And with that, they left, leaving my mother and her family stunned, grateful." So, what then is this holiday, and what should it mean to us? We examine three stages of Sukkot. First, we will study the biblical holiday as it was meant to be lived in the land of Israel. Second, Sukkot in exile throughout the centuries. And finally, Sukkot today, with the Jewish people restored to its land. Only in understanding what Sukkot was can we appreciate what Sukkot is, and why a holiday which seems so out of place in today's day and age is actually one of the most relevant, one whose message speaks profoundly to the moral and spiritual challenges of our time. First, the biblical holiday. In Tanakh, in the Bible, Sukkot is referred to as the Chag HaAsif, the harvest festival. It occurs at the close of the harvest season and right before the rainy season. The two main mitzvot, the two central rituals of Sukkot that have been observed throughout the ages, are first, Basukkot Teshvu Shivat Yamim, that for the 7 days of this holiday we dwell in a ramshackle hut, performing inside it the basic activities that usually occur in our homes, eating, drinking, even sleeping. The meaning of this ritual, we are further informed, is a remembrance of Israel's wandering in the desert after the Exodus, without any permanent home for shelter. The second ritual of Sukkot centers on what are known as the Arba Minim, the four agricultural species, the date palm or lulav, the citron or etrog, and the branches of myrtle and willow, hadasim and aravot. This ritual can be performed anywhere, but ideally it was meant to be performed in the temple. Usmachtem lifnei Hashem shivat yamim, you shall rejoice with these agricultural items in the presence of God for 7 days. As a harvest festival, Sukkot is essentially Jewish Thanksgiving, or more properly understood, it is the original Thanksgiving. On this holiday, we are intended to thank God for what we have, and at certain moments to beseech God for abundant rain and crops in the year to come. The verses recited while clutching the four species were the verses of Hallel, the Psalms of Thanksgiving. And these four species, rightly understood, represent the agriculture and the irrigation of the land of Israel. Foremost among them is the palm frond, which is meant specifically to be taken not from any palm, but from the date palm. The date palms of Judea were once a symbol of the Jewish state, and this is because the Holy Land was known for the quality of its dates and its flourishing palm trees. According to one article, at the time, quote, when the Romans invaded ancient Judea, thick forests of date palms, towering up to 80 feet high and 7 miles wide, covered the Jordan River Valley. And so when the Bible calls Eretz Yisrael the land of milk and honey, it is to date honey, not bee honey, that it is referring. For biblical Israel, The lulav, the date palm frond, is the supreme symbol of the harvest, and thus one of the supreme symbols of Israel itself. Sukkot, then, is intended for a people living in its land in an agricultural society. It is a holiday for a nation state and for its encounter with nature. And rightly understood, the biblical version of this holiday is intended to counter potential spiritual pitfalls that are perilous possibilities in this encounter with nature. One is paganism, or the worship of nature, and the second is hubris, arrogance, or the worship of the self. Now, for the purpose of our discussion, we must understand what exactly we mean by nature. For us, nature means leaving the city and going to the Catskills. That is not what nature means for the Bible. In his book, Reflection on the Psalms, Lewis notes that what we call nature does not actually exist in the Bible. For us, nature is going out to a place where there are trees, where there's grass, what Jews from the 1950s would have called the country. That is what nature for us means. For people living in the biblical age, as Lewis notes, nature is just a description of the world. It is what water is to a fish. It's not something separate from the world in which they found themselves. It was the world in which they found themselves. And we have to appreciate in this regard that the difference between biblical Judaism and paganism was not merely one of, is there one God or many gods? Another equally important question was, is nature created by God, or is nature itself divine? Creation, the Jewish concept of creation, was in the ancient Near East a surprisingly rare doctrine. And the notion of a God who in the beginning created heaven and earth was unheard of in the ancient world. As Lewis writes, I suspect that many people assume that some clear doctrine of creation underlies all religions, that in paganism, the gods or one of the gods usually created the world, even that religions normally begin by answering the question, who made the world? In reality, creation, in any unambiguous sense, seems to be a surprisingly rare doctrine, Lewis writes, and when stories about it occur in paganism, they are often religiously unimportant. They are on the fringe where religion tails off into what was perhaps felt even at the time to be more like fairy tale. Thus, as Lewis recounts in one Egyptian story, a god called Atum came up out of the water and, being apparently a hermaphrodite, begot and bore the next two gods. After that, things could develop. In another, the whole senate of the gods came out of Nun, the deep. According to a Babylonian myth, before heaven and earth were made, a being called Aspu begot, and a being called Tiamat bore, Lachmu and Lachamu, who in their turn produced Anshar and Kishar. We are, he writes, expressly told that this pair were greater than their parents, so it is more like a myth of evolution than of creation. In the Norse myth, we begin with ice and fire, and indeed with a north and south, amidst all of which somehow a giant comes to life who bears from his armpit a son and daughter. Greek mythology starts with heaven and earth already in existence, end quote. And the point, Lewis tells us, is not that these myths are crude. What's most interesting is not even the answers or explanations for nature that they are giving us. What is most interesting is that there are questions that they are not even asking. As an example, Lewis gives the case of a man who has arrived 10 minutes late to Shakespeare's Macbeth. I am enormously sympathetic to this case because I arrive late for events like these, and I also fall asleep during films and always need to be caught up. So a man shows up late for Macbeth and is asked what happens, and he would be properly answered, say, with the words, oh, first three witches came in, and then there was a scene between an old king and a wounded soldier. That is the sort of question the myths are in fact answering. But the very different question, Lewis writes, the question of how does a play originate? Does it write itself? Do the actors make it up as they go along? Or is there someone not on the stage, not like the people on the stage, someone we don't see, who invented it all and caused it to be? This, Lewis says, that is rarely asked or answered by any of the pagan civilizations. But of course, Jews, Israel, did ask this question and answered it. And so if I can extend the Shakespearean metaphor just a bit, if all the world's a stage, biblical Israel is not only interested in what is happening on the stage, but who made the stage and who wrote the play. And so when the Bible begins by giving us answers, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Then nature de-divinized all of a sudden, is seen not as divine, but as a masterpiece of the Almighty. Or as the Psalms say, the heavens proclaim the glory of God. This was nothing less than a revolution. And we, who do not live in that world, we for whom nature is something separate from our lives, do not understand how strong the temptation was to see nature as divine. One of the most interesting characters on the show on the History Channel called Vikings is a monk who was captured by the Norsemen and experiences both monotheism and Viking paganism. And when he is later asked in which he believes, he says, in the gentle patter of the rain, I hear my God, but in the thunder, I feel Thor. This is my agony. This is the temptation for all who lived in nature, when nature was the world in which they actually lived. And so for biblical Israel, the danger of worshiping nature was ever present. Because, in Lewis's words, the difference for many was momentous but subtle between hearing in the thunder the voice of God or the voice of a God. And so here Sukkot provides a proper perspective. Precisely at the central moment in the cycle of nature, when veneration of nature itself is such a possibility, Israelite farmers are called to sit in a sukkah and remember thereby the Exodus, when God made manifest his absolute power over nature, which was in Egypt worshipped as gods, when he blotted out the sun, when he split the sea. And they take the four species representing their harvest in their hands, and they praise the Creator, seeing in nature not gods, but a gift of God. But if nature, for Judaism, has been de-divinized, then the corresponding danger is that the Israelite, having harnessed nature, having created crops, will forget the divine entirely and ascribe his achievement to himself. This is the central concern of the book of Deuteronomy, that after entering the land and working it and experiencing successful harvest after harvest, the Jews who in the desert sought sustenance only from God would forget that what they have achieved is the benevolent blessing of the Master of the Universe. V'ram levavacha, the Torah warns, you will become arrogant and you will forget the Lord your God. Ki hu hanotein lecha koach la'asot chayil. For it is he who is actually blessing you with abundance. As Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has put it, and I'm quoting in part, were one to summarize Deuteronomy, it would be, for 40 years you and your parents wandered in the wilderness. Only by a series of miracles did you have anything to eat or drink. Now you are on the brink of the promised land. It is here that the challenge will begin, and it will be the hardest challenge of all because it will not look like a challenge. Moses gives voice to the most counterintuitive of messages in Deuteronomy, that one of the greatest of challenges is not slavery but freedom, not poverty but affluence. The paradox, writes Rabbi Sacks, is that when we have the most to thank God for, that is when we are in the greatest danger of not thanking or even thinking of God at all. And as Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch notes, this concern was particularly acute at the moment of the harvest, when one looks at all that has been reaped and is all too apt to attribute it entirely to his own effort, to his own gifts, to his own power. Imagine someone working in Judea or in the Galil or in Eiver HaYarden in what is now the Jordan, gazing at the beautiful bushels and baskets, the fabulous fruit, and thinking to himself, I am one fantastic farmer. I did this. The Torah, in envisioning this scene, employs the imagery of the arm and the hand. V'amarta bilavavecha, kochi v'otzem yadi asali et achayel hazeh. In gazing at this fruit, you will say in your heart that the power of my own hand has brought me this abundance. What do we see when we see this fruit? What do we see when we see this harvest? Do we see our own power, or do we have gratitude to God? I actually have a friend who was working as a CEO in 2000, and when the Bush-Cheney ticket was elected, he was invited with other CEOs to the White House or to some dinner near the White House where both the president and the vice president would attend. And he was seated at a table with Vice President Cheney, and he had ordered a kosher meal, and it wasn't coming. And then as everyone is digging into their own portions, all of a sudden, an enormous fruit basket arrives, which is placed in front of him, and it's just magnificent. And the Vice President, who, as you know, had some issues with diets and was intrigued by this, looked at the basket and says to the CEO, "How did you get that?" Not knowing that he kept kosher. And without batting an eye, my friend looked at Cheney and said, "You got to know people in this town." Okay. And so, what do we see when we see the basket? Do we attribute this to God or to ourselves? Do we give gratitude or do we say, the power of my hand has brought me this wealth? At that particular time, at the harvest season, he is called by the Bible to bid farewell to his field, to ascend to Jerusalem, to enter the temple, to take lulav and etrog in hand, botanical specimens symbolizing agricultural achievement, and with those arms and hands that he might believe are the source of his strength, he is called to hold aloft the symbols of the harvest and transform these embodiments of material success into the ultimate representation of gratitude to God. And he is required for 7 days to dwell not in the home he has built, but in a sukkah, remembering an age when manna fell from heaven and water flowed from a rock, when Israel knew every day that they relied on God's grace in order to remind him, the farmer, that he too relies on God's grace as well. This is the Sukkot of the age of the Bible and for the Second Temple period as well. We have one last glimpse at the Sukkot in an extraordinary letter discovered by the archaeologist Yigal Yadin, which was written by no one less than Shimon Bar Kokhba himself, while in the midst of rebellion. And the letter reads as follows. Shimon to Yehuda, son of Menashe at Kiryat Arbaya, I have delivered to you 2 donkeys in order that you dispatch along with them 2 men to Yehonatan and to Mesabala, in order that they pack up and deliver to the camp palm branches and citrons, and you are to send additional persons from your place and let them bring you myrtle branches and willows and prepare them and deliver them to the camp because the population is large. And he concludes, farewell. But they, of course, did not farewell. Bar Kokhba fell. The rebellion failed. And in a cruel twist of fate, the date palm also became utilized as a symbol of Jewish defeat. The Romans announced the conquest of Judea and the destruction of the temple by minting coins featuring Jewish captives sitting bound under a Judean date palm. The coins themselves boldly emblazoned with the words, Judea Capta, Judea has been captured. And over the centuries, Jews wandered the world, ultimately forced to abandon agriculture as a source of sustenance, living not in nature but in cities and towns or shtetls or ghettos. But Sukkot, the agricultural holiday of the Holy Land, continued to be observed in exile. And this brings us to the holiday's second stage. Wherever Jews were, throughout the ages, they sat in Sukkot. And over the centuries, the Sukkah came to symbolize not only the Israelite wandering in the desert, but also the wanderings of the Jews throughout the world, from place to place, never staying long, but always loyal to God. The Talmud codified as a matter of law and Jewish thinkers stressed as a matter of theology that the Sukkah is considered a dirat arai, a temporary dwelling, one made to last only 7 days. One reason given in the Talmud as to why a Sukkah cannot be too tall is that then it's akin to a permanent dwelling place. Moreover, a Sukkah, as codified, need not have a mezuzah precisely because it is not a permanent home. The Sukkah represented, in other words, the very transience of Jewish existence, which rightly understood reflects reality itself. The Sukkah is a temporary dwelling, and truly so is the very world in which we live. Paul Johnson's History of the Jews concludes with the following statement. The Jews, he wrote, were not just innovators, they were also exemplars and epitomizers of the human condition. The Jews were the emblem of homeless and vulnerable humanity. But, he writes, is not the whole earth no more than a temporary transit camp? In further expression of this motif, most Jewish communities chose Sukkot as the holiday on which to read in synagogue the book of Ecclesiastes, or Kohelet, which more than any other biblical book reflects on the changing of generations and on human mortality. Ki gam lo yeda ha'adam et ito, Ecclesiastes tells us. For man also knoweth not his time. As the fishes are taken in an evil net, and the birds are caught in the snare, even so are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. Death, Kohelet tells us, over and over and over. Death comes for us all. Or as Ecclesiastes famously begins, Hevel havalim hakol havel, which rightly translated means, all is transient. Sukkot became a time for reflecting on mortality, finitude, the temporary nature of life, the greatest symbol of which was the sukkah itself. And yet, even as Sukkot took on the mark of mortality, it remained for Jews a day of celebration and gratitude. Not only joyous, but one of the most joyous moments of the Jewish year. You shall celebrate before the Lord your God for 7 days. Here, Rabbinic Judaism makes one of the most astonishing philosophical leaps. The experience of mortality and of joy are not only irreconcilable, they are intertwined. Joy lies in the realization of finitude, not in its denial. As Leon Cass has written, mortality makes life matter. The same Jews from whom life had so often been cruelly stolen are the same Jews who toasted L'chaim to life. And on Sukkot, in the face of this finitude that the Sukkah represented, what reminded Jews most of their eternity, what reminded them that they were part of something much larger, linked to a land, that their journey throughout the earth began with Abraham's expedition to that land and would conclude with a return to that land. What reminded them of all this was the other mitzvah of the holiday, holding aloft the four species, the symbol of the Holy Land, and singing psalms of joy as they did so. For Jews who lived in the Middle East or Mediterranean societies, acquiring these symbols of Israelite agriculture was not that difficult. But for many Jews spread throughout Europe, it was almost impossible. Jewish responsa report that often the palm frond was reused from year to year. But the most difficult item to acquire was the etrog, the citron. And yet acquire it Jews did, often with one shtetl sharing the same small piece of fruit. And as they did so, they were suddenly linked not only with Jews all over the world, but with Israelites tilling the soil in their land long ago. And here a fascinating union of Jewish morality, botanical science, and biblical aesthetics reveals itself. While three of the four species are specifically set out, specifically named, the citron is not explicitly identified in the Torah, but is identified only by its appellation, pri etz hadar, the beautiful fruit of a tree, or more literally, the fruit of a beautiful tree, which Jewish tradition understood as referring to the etrog, to the citron. One might have expected Jews, especially those facing difficulty in acquiring the etrog, that they might have said that any beautiful fruit could serve this ritualistic function. But they stoutly insisted that Jewish tradition teaches that the fruit of this beautiful tree is the etrog and only the etrog, the citron and only the citron. Yet it is utterly unclear as to why the etrog tree is at all glorious, why it deserves the description, a beautiful tree. As I read in one of the most important and instructive books in my entire library, the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food, by Chef and Rabbi Gil Marks, quote, historically the citron, to put it mildly, was not a very useful plant. It was not the most hardy tree. Its wood was not prized as lumber. It was not one of the tallest trees. It was vulnerable to cold temperatures. Nor were its fruits considered a luxury food in the ancient world, like cherries and kumquats. So yes, the citron is not unlike the lemon, and yes, we are reliably informed by certain Jewish sages of the 20th century that the lemon tree is very pretty and the lemon flower sweet. But nevertheless, surely there are more beautiful trees. Surely there are more beautiful specimens of fruit. So what makes the etrog hadar glorious, a botanical treasure? And the answer, I think, lies in the following fascinating fact that Rabbi Marks notes. Quote, the citron is unique in that it is the only tree that can flower and bear fruit throughout the year under proper conditions. It can also distinctively retain the fruit from 1 year to the next. Thus, the citron is the only tree that can have buds, blossoms, and mature fruit on the tree at the same time. The etrog tree, in other words, embodies for the Jews what is the most beautiful, the most glorious, the most profoundly Jewish value of all, continuity and the bond between generations. Indeed, the Talmud itself notes this botanical fact with a pun on the word hadar, which literally means beautiful or glorious, but which they interpret as saying that the glory of the Etrog lies in the fact that it is a fruit which is hadar be'ilano mishana lishana, that the fruit is retained on the tree from year to year, meaning that the tree is the embodiment of endurance, because through peoplehood, through the link between generations, through transmission, Jews achieve immortality. Thus, if the sukkah represents transience, the four species represent continuity, eternity, and the etrog tree is a sublime example. Or as Leon Kass puts it in another context, in perpetuation we send forth not just the seed of our bodies, but also the bearer of our hopes, our truths, and those of our tradition. If our children are to flower, we need to sow them well and nurture them, cultivate them in rich and wholesome soil, clothe them in fine and decent opinions and mores, and direct them toward the highest light to grow straight and tall, that they may take our place as we took that of those who planted us and made way for us, so that in time they too may make way and plant. But, he adds, if they are truly to flower, we must go to seed, we must wither and give ground. And so mortality and eternity, finitude and eternal peoplehood, all came together on this holiday. Whether in the desert sun of Yemen or the snowy drifts of the Ukraine, Jews, few of whom had harvested anything, sat for generations in their Sukkot and sang Hallel with their lulavs and etrogs, united across the world, a symbol of an eternal people that exile and even the very fact of death itself could not destroy. And then, the Jews returned to their land and a Jewish state was restored. But that is not all that was restored. The Judean date palm, once the most famous symbol of a fruitful and fecund land, had been extinct, and Israel set about ensuring that Eretz Yisrael was a land of milk and date honey once again. But to do that, they needed to find date palms. In the words of Ari Zivitovsky, the story of the reintroduction of date palms in the early days of the state reads like an espionage thriller. And I'm quoting here. The best place to get saplings was Iraq, but Israel and Iraq had no diplomatic or trade relations. More than that, there was no way that the Iraqis would sell anything to the Jews. The Mossad had a solution, and I like that the Mossad was working on this issue, on how to get lulavs to the land of Israel. It sent a few agents to Iran, posing as French businessmen. After several months of confidence building, the Iranians agreed to serve as interlocutors with the Iraqis. The Israelis purchased 75,000 date palm saplings and asked that they be shipped to Egypt. Before arriving, the ship's manifest was changed to direct it to France. In an amazing turn of events, pirates boarded the ship in the Mediterranean and stole only one thing on the ship, the date palms. These saplings mysteriously turned up in Haifa and were used to rekindle the now very successful Israel date business in both the Arava and the Beit She'an Valley, end quote. And that is how the date palm returned to Israel. And now, when we consider the world in which we find ourselves, we realize that Sukkot today speaks to us more than ever. The Jewish people is back in its land. Meanwhile, throughout the world, the very ideas that the Bible had once taught the world to reject, a worship of nature, is in its own way, no pun intended, sprouting once again. Writing about nature and the Bible in the 1950s, C.S. Lewis mused that the urge of pagan worship with which biblical Israelites struggled is an instinct that, quote, Europe has not felt for 1,000 years, end quote. He could not write that today. And even when nature is not embraced explicitly as divine, we find nevertheless, all too often, a veneration for nature replacing the commands of God, the moral teachings of the Bible and Rabbinic Judaism, and its emphasis on ritual and continuity. One op-ed in the newspaper known as The Foreword actually argued, and I'm not making this up, that many Jews around the world should ditch the lulav and etrog on Sukkot in order to help the environment. And I quote, each year we produce a massive carbon footprint in the lead up to Sukkot's celebration of abundance and its message to live more sustainably and more in concert with the seasons. I'm talking about the lulav and etrog. As compost friendly as they may be, they are flown in from Israel and shipped en masse to American Jewish communities that couldn't grow a palm tree or an etra grove if they tried. What luck, says the article, we're smack in the middle of the harvest season here in North America. We have maple and oak and aspen leaves. We have squash, apples, and pumpkins in abundance. So why are we still insisting on importing astronomically expensive produce and leaves from the Middle East rather than picking an apple off our trees, using maple and oak branches from our own yards, and shaking them the same way we do with the lulav? End quote. The irony could not be more painful. An argument is put forward by an American Jew in an American Jewish newspaper that a ritual that for over 2,000 years linked exiled members of a nation all over the world to each other by connecting them to their land should now be all of a sudden abandoned in the name of the Zeitgeist, a perfect combination of extreme environmentalism and assimilation. Meanwhile, Sukkot speaks to a nation that has rebuilt itself, created a country, and turned a desert into an Eden. This state is indeed a tribute to Jewish ingenuity, but Sukkot also reminds us not to forget that these achievements, rightly understood, are themselves a sign of God and of chosenness. Or as Paul Johnson put it, in the 20th century, over 100 states came into being, but Israel is the only one that could be considered a miracle. And in fact, one of the central symbols of Sukkot reminds us of this truth. While date palms were introduced into the land of Israel, the species known as the Judean date palm, which once towered over Israel at the time of the Roman invasion, had, it would seem, disappeared forever. But 40 years ago, the archaeological excavators of Masada discovered a storage of date seeds from dates that had been stockpiled by the besieged defenders of the fortress. Assuming the seeds were an uninteresting artifact, they lay dormant in a drawer until, decades later, they were given to a scientist at the Arava Institute in Kibbutz Keturah. The seeds were pre-treated in hormone-rich solution and then planted. The result, I quote from the newspaper report, it has 5 leaves, stands 14 inches high, and is nicknamed Methuselah. It looks like an ordinary date palm seedling, but for botanist Elaine Soloway, possibly related, it is a piece of history brought back to life. Planted on January 25th, the seedling growing in the black pot in Soloway's nursery on this kibbutz in Israel's Arava desert is 2,000 years old, more than twice as old as the 900-year-old biblical character who lent his name to the young tree. It is the oldest seed ever known to produce a viable young tree. The seed, the article further reports, that produced Methuselah was discovered during archaeological excavations at Herod's palace on Masada near the Dead Sea. Its age has been confirmed by carbon dating. Scientists hope that the unique seedling will eventually yield vital clues to the medicinal properties of the fruit of the Judean date tree, which was long thought to be extinct. And the article concludes, the ancient Judean date, renowned for its succulence and famed for its many medicinal properties, had been lost to history until now. You can visit this tree today. It is planted in the sacred soil of the land of Israel, and it is flourishing. A date pit belonging to the dead defenders of Masada, now growing a date palm, a lulav tree, in a Jewish state. To see it grow is to know that this tree is simultaneously incredibly old and incredibly new. It is a 2,000-year-old seed sprouting a young sapling. It is hard to come up with a more sublime symbol of an eternal people in a resurrected state. One can only imagine how glorious it would be to utilize a lulav from Methuselah, from the first Judean date palm in millennia. What a joining of generations one would feel in such an act. Yet rightly understood, every observance of Sukkot involves just such a joining. To sit in a sukkah or to grasp a lulav and etrog is to take part in the Jewish journey of generations. It is to find one's place in the eternal people that defeated death and to link oneself as a Jew to all that has been, all that is, and all that is yet to be. Thank you very much. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. If you enjoyed this lecture, please be sure to sign up for future updates and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Thank you for watching.